Chapter 4. At Ransom's waking, something happened to him which perhaps never happens to a man until he is out of his own world. He saw reality and thought it was a dream. He opened his eyes and saw a strange heraldically coloured tree loaded with yellow fruits and silver leaves. Round the base of the indigo stem was coiled a small dragon covered with scales of red gold. He recognised the garden of the Hesperides at once. "This is the most vivid dream I have ever had," he thought. By some means or other he then realized that he was awake, but extreme comfort and some trance-like quality, both in the sleep which had just left him and in the experience to which he had awaked, kept him lying motionless. He remembered how, in the very different world called Malacandra, that cold, archaic world, as it now seemed to him, he had met the original of the Cyclops, a giant in a cave and a shepherd. Were all the things which appeared as mythology on earth scattered through other worlds as realities? Then the realization came to him, you are in an unknown planet, naked and alone, and that may be a dangerous animal. But he was not badly frightened. He knew that the ferocity of terrestrial animals was, by cosmic standards, an exception, and had found kindness in stranger creatures than this. But he lay quiet a little longer and looked at it. It was a creature of the lizard type, about the size of a St. Bernard dog, with a serrated back. Its eyes were open. Presently he ventured to rise on one elbow. The creature went on looking at him. He noticed that the island was perfectly level. He sat up and saw, between the stems of the trees, that they were in calm water. The sea looked like gilded glass. He resumed his study of the dragon. Could this be a rational animal? A now, as they said in Malacandra, and the very thing he had been sent there to meet? It did not look like one, but it was worth trying. Speaking in the old solar tongue, he formed his first sentence, and his own voice sounded to him unfamiliar. Stranger, he said, I have been sent to your world through the heaven by the servants of Meleldil. Do you give me welcome? The thing looked at him very hard, and perhaps very wisely. Then, for the first time, it shut its eyes. This seemed an unpromising start. Ransom decided to rise to his feet. The dragon reopened its eyes. He stood looking at it while you could count 20, very uncertain how to proceed. Then he saw that it was beginning to uncoil itself. By a great effort of will he stood his ground. Whether the thing were rational or irrational, flight could hardly help him for long. It detached itself from the tree, gave itself a shake, and opened two shining reptilian wings, bluish gold and bat-like. When it had shaken these and closed them again, it gave Ransom another long stare, and at last, half waddling and half crawling, made its way to the edge of the island and buried its long metallic-looking snout in the water. When it had drunk, it raised its head and gave a kind of croaking bleat, which was not entirely unmusical. Then it turned, looked yet again at Ransom, and finally approached him. "It's madness to wait for it," said the false reason, but Ransom set his teeth and stood. It came right up and began nudging him with its cold snout about his knees. He was in great perplexity. Was it rational, and was this how it talked? Was it irrational but friendly, and if so, how should he respond? You could hardly stroke a creature with scales, or was it merely scratching itself against him? At that moment, with a suddenness which convinced him it was only a beast, it seemed to forget all about him, turned away, and began tearing up the herbage with great avidity. Feeling that honour was now satisfied, he also turned away back to the woods. There were trees near him loaded with the fruit which he had already tasted, but his attention was diverted by a strange appearance a little farther off. Amid the darker foliage of a greenish-grey thicket, something seemed to be sparkling. The impression, caught out of the corner of his eye, had been that of a greenhouse roof with the sun on it. Now that he looked at it squarely, it still suggested glass, but glass in perpetual motion. Light seemed to be coming and going in a spasmodic fashion. Just as he was moving to investigate this phenomenon, he was startled by a touch on his left leg. The beast had followed him. It was once more nosing and nudging. Ransom quickened his pace, so did the dragon. He stopped, so did it. When he went on again, it accompanied him so closely that its side pressed against his thighs, and sometimes its cold, hard, heavy foot descended on his. The arrangement was so little to his satisfaction that he was beginning to wonder seriously how he could put an end to it, when suddenly his whole attention was attracted by something else. Over his head there hung from a hairy tube-like branch a great spherical object, almost transparent and shining. It held an area of reflected light in it, and at one place a suggestion of rainbow colouring. So this was the explanation of the glass-like appearance in the wood. And looking round, he perceived innumerable shimmering globes of the same kind in every direction. He began to examine the nearest one attentively. At first he thought it was moving, then he thought it was not. Moved by a natural impulse, he put out his hand to touch it. Immediately his head, face, and shoulders were drenched with what seemed, in that warm world, an ice-cold shower-bath, and his nostrils filled with a sharp, shrill, exquisite scent that somehow brought to his mind the verse in Pope, "Die of a rose in aromatic pain." Such was the refreshment that he seemed to himself to have been, till now, but half awake. When he opened his eyes, which had closed involuntarily at the shock of moisture, all the colours about him seemed richer, and the dimness of that world seemed clarified. A re-enchantment fell upon him. The golden beast at his side seemed no longer either a danger or a nuisance. If a naked man and a wise dragon were indeed the sole inhabitants of this floating paradise, then this also was fitting. For at that moment he had a sensation not of following an adventure, but of enacting a myth. To be the figure that he was in this unearthly pattern appeared sufficient. He turned again to the tree. The thing that had drenched him was quite vanished. The tube, or branch, deprived of its pendant globe, now ended in a little quivering orifice from which there hung a bead of crystal moisture. He looked round in some bewilderment. The grove was still full of its iridescent fruit, but now he perceived there was a slow, continual movement. A second later he had mastered the phenomenon. Each of the bright spheres was very gradually increasing in size, and each, on reaching a certain dimension, vanished with a faint noise, and in its place there was a momentary dampness on the soil, and a soon-fading delicious fragrance and coldness in the air. In fact, the things were not fruit at all, but bubbles. The trees, he christened them at that moment, were bubble trees. Their life, apparently, consisted in drawing up water from the ocean and then expelling it in this form, but enriched by its short sojourn in their sappy inwards. He sat down to feed his eyes upon the spectacle. Now that he knew the secret, he could explain to himself why this wood looked and felt so different from every other part of the island. Each bubble, looked at individually, could be seen to emerge from its parent branch as a mere bead, the size of a pea, and swell and burst. But looking at the wood as a whole, one was conscious only of a continual faint disturbance of light, an elusive interference with the prevailing Perelandrian silence, an unusual coolness in the air, and a fresher quality in the perfume. To a man born in our world, it felt a more outdoor place than the open parts of the island, or even the sea. Looking at a fine cluster of the bubbles which hung above his head, he thought how easy it would be to get up and plunge oneself through the whole lot of them, and to feel all at once that magical refreshment multiplied tenfold. But he was restrained by the same sort of feeling which had restrained him overnight from tasting a second gourd. He had always disliked the people who encored a favourite air in an opera. "That just spoils it," had been his comment. But this now appeared to him as a principle of far wider application and deeper moment. This itch to have things over again, as if life were a film that could be unrolled twice or even made to work backwards. Was it possibly the root of all evil? No. Of course the love of money was called that. But money itself, perhaps one valued it chiefly as a defence against chance, a security for being able to have things over again, a means of arresting the unrolling of the film. He was startled from his meditation by the physical discomfort of some weight on his knees. The dragon had lain down and deposited its long, heavy head across them. "Do you know," he said to it in English, "that you are a considerable nuisance?" It never moved. He decided that he had better try and make friends with it. He stroked the hard, dry head, but the creature took no notice. Then his hand passed lower down and found softer surface, or even a chink in the mail. Ah, that was where it liked being tickled. It grunted and shot out a long, cylindrical, slate-coloured tongue to lick him. It rolled round on its back, revealing an almost white belly, which Ransom kneaded with his toes. His acquaintance with the dragon prospered exceedingly. In the end it went to sleep. He rose and got a second shower from a bubble tree. This made him feel so fresh and alert that he began to think of food. He had forgotten whereabouts on the island the yellow gourds were to be found, and as he set out to look for them, he discovered that it was difficult to walk. For a moment he wondered whether the liquid in the bubbles had some intoxicating quality, but a glance around assured him of the real reason. The plain of copper-coloured heather before him, even as he watched, swelled into a low hill, and the low hill moved in his direction. Spellbound anew at the sight of land rolling towards him, like water in a wave, he forgot to adjust himself to the movement and lost his feet. Picking himself up, he proceeded more carefully. This time there was no doubt about it, the sea was rising. Where two neighbouring woods made a vista to the edge of this living raft, he could see troubled water, and the warm wind was now strong enough to ruffle his hair. He made his way gingerly towards the coast, but before he reached it he passed some bushes which carried a rich crop of oval green berries, about three times the size of almonds. He picked one and broke it in two. The flesh was dryish and bread-like, something of the same kind as a banana. It turned out to be good to eat. It did not give the orgiastic and almost alarming pleasure of the gourds, but rather the specific pleasure of plain food, the delight of munching and being nourished, a sober certainty of waking bliss. A man, or at least a man like Ransom, felt he ought to say grace over it, and so he presently did. The gourds would have required rather an oratorio or a mystical meditation. But the meal had its unexpected highlights. Every now and then one struck a berry which had a bright red centre, and these were so savoury, so memorable among a thousand tastes, that he would have begun to look for them and to feed on them only, but that he was once more forbidden by that same inner adviser which had already spoken to him twice since he came to Perelandra. Now on earth, thought Ransom, they'd soon discover how to breed these red hearts, and they'd cost a great deal more than the others. Money, in fact, would provide the means of saying encore in a voice that could not be disobeyed. When he had finished his meal, he went down to the water's edge to drink, but before he arrived there it was already up to the water's edge. The island at that moment was a little valley of bright land, nestling between hills of green water, and as he lay on his belly to drink, he had the extraordinary experience of dipping his mouth in a sea that was higher than the shore. Then he sat upright for a bit, with his legs dangling over the edge among the red weeds that fringed this little country. His solitude became a more persistent element in his consciousness. What had he been brought here to do? A wild fancy came into his head that this empty world had been waiting for him as for its first inhabitant, that he was singled out to be the founder, the beginner. It was strange that the utter loneliness through all these hours had not troubled him so much as one night of it on Malacandra. He thought the difference lay in this, that mere chance, or what he took for chance, had turned him adrift in Mars. But here he knew that he was part of a plan. He was no longer unattached, no longer on the outside. As his country climbed the smooth mountains of dimly lustrous water, he had frequent opportunity to see that many other islands were close at hand. They varied from his own island and from one another in their colouring more than he would have thought possible. It was a wonder to see these big mats or carpets of land tossing all around him like yachts in harbour on a rough day, their trees each moment at a different angle, just as the masts of the yachts would be. It was a wonder to see some edge of vivid green or velvety crimson come creeping over the top of a wave far above him, and then wait till the whole country unrolled itself down the wave's side for him to study. Sometimes his own land and a neighbouring land would be on opposite slopes of a trough, with only a narrow strait of water between them. And then, for a moment, you were cheated with the semblance of a terrestrial landscape. It looked exactly as though you were in a well-wooded valley with a river at the bottom of it. But while you watched, that seeming river did the impossible. It thrust itself up so that the land on either side sloped downwards from it, and then farther up still, and shouldered half the landscape out of sight beyond its ridge, and became a huge greeny-gold hogsback of water hanging in the sky and threatening to engulf your own land, which now was concave and reeled backwards to the next roller, and rushing upwards became convex again. A clanging, whirring noise startled him. For a moment he fancied he was in Europe and that a plane was flying low over his head. Then he recognised his friend, the dragon. Its tail was streaked out straight behind it, so that it looked like a flying worm, and it was heading for an island about half a mile away. Following its course with his eyes, he saw two long lines of winged objects, dark against the gold firmament, approaching the same island from the left and the right. But they were not bat-winged reptiles. Peering hard into the distance, he decided that they were birds, and a musical chattering noise, presently wafted to him by a change of the wind, confirmed this belief. They must have been a little larger than swans. Their steady approach to the same island for which the dragon was heading fixed his attention and filled him with a vague feeling of expectation. What followed next raised this to positive excitement. He became aware of some creamily foamed disturbance in the water, much nearer, and making for the same island. A whole fleet of objects was moving in formation. He rose to his feet. Then the lift of a wave cut them off from his sight. Next moment they were visible again, hundreds of feet below him. Silver-coloured objects, all alive with circling and frisking movements. He lost them again and swore. In such a very uneventful world they had become important. Ah, here they were again. Fish, certainly. Very large, obese, dolphin-like fish, two long lines together, some of them spouting columns of rainbow-coloured water from their noses, and one leader. There was something queer about the leader, some sort of projection or malformation on the back. If only the things would remain visible for more than 50 seconds at a time. They had almost reached that other island now, and the birds were all descending to meet them at its edge. There was the leader again, with his hump or pillar on his back. A moment of wild incredulity followed, and then Ransom was balanced with legs wide apart on the utmost fringe of his own island and shouting for all he was worth. For at the very moment when the leading fish had reached that neighbouring land, the land had risen up on a wave between him and the sky, and he had seen, in perfect and unmistakable silhouette, the thing on the fish's back reveal itself as a human form. A human form which stepped ashore, turned with a slight inclination of its body towards the fish, and then vanished from sight as the whole island slid over the shoulder of the billow. With beating heart, Ransom waited till it was in view again. This time it was not between him and the sky. For a second or so the human figure was undiscoverable. A stab of something like despair pierced him. Then he picked it out again, a tiny, darkish shape moving slowly between him and a patch of blue vegetation. He waved and gesticulated and shouted till his throat was hoarse, but it took no notice of him. Every now and then he lost sight of it. Even when he found it again, he sometimes doubted whether it were not an optical illusion, some chance figuration of foliage which his intense desire had assimilated to the shape of a man. But always, just before he had despaired, it would become unmistakable again. Then his eyes began to grow tired, and he knew that the longer he looked, the less he would see. But he went on looking nonetheless. At last, from mere exhaustion, he sat down. The solitude, which up till now had been scarcely painful, had become a horror. Any return to it was a possibility he dared not face. The drugging and entrancing beauty had vanished from his surroundings. Take that one human form away, and all the rest of this world was now pure nightmare, a horrible cell or trap in which he was imprisoned. The suspicion that he was beginning to suffer from hallucinations crossed his mind. He had a picture of living forever and ever on this hideous island, always really alone, but always haunted by the phantoms of human beings who would come up to him with smiles and outstretched hands and then fade away as he approached them. Bowing his head on his knees, he set his teeth and endeavoured to restore some order in his mind. At first he found he was merely listening to his own breathing and counting the beats of his heart. But he tried again, and presently succeeded. And then, like revelation, came the very simple idea that if he wished to attract the attention of this man-like creature, he must wait till he was on the crest of a wave, and then stand up, so that it would see him outlined against the sky. 3 times he waited till the shore whereon he stood became a ridge, and rose, swaying to the movement of his strange country, gesticulating. 4th time he succeeded. The neighbouring island was, of course, lying for the moment beneath him like a valley. Quite unmistakably, the small dark figure waved back. It detached itself from a confusing background of greenish vegetation and began running towards him, that is, towards the nearer coast of its own island, across an orange-coloured field. It ran easily. The heaving surface of the field did not seem to trouble it. Then his own land reeled downwards and backwards, and a great wall of water pushed its way up between the 2 countries and cut each off from sight of the other. A moment later, and Ransom, from the valley in which he now stood, saw the orange-coloured land pouring itself like a moving hillside down the slightly convex slope of a wave far above him. The creature was still running. The width of water between the 2 islands was about 30 feet, and the creature was less than 100 yards away from him. He knew now that it was not merely man-like, but a man. A green man on an orange field, green like the beautifully coloured green beetle in an English garden, running downhill towards him with easy strides and very swiftly. Then the seas lifted his own land, and the green man became a foreshortened figure far below him, like an actor seen from the gallery at Covent Garden. Ransom stood on the very brink of his island, straining his body forward and shouting. The green man looked up. He was apparently shouting too, with his hands arched about his mouth. But the roar of the sea smothered the noise, and the next moment Ransom's island dropped into the trough of the wave, and the high green ridge of sea cut off his view. It was maddening. He was tortured with the fear that the distance between the islands might be increasing. Thank God, here came the orange land over the crest, following him down into the pit. And there was the stranger, now on the very shore, face to face with him. For 1 second the alien eyes looked at his, full of love and welcome. Then the whole face changed. A shock as of disappointment and astonishment passed over it. Ransom realized, not without a disappointment of his own, that he had been mistaken for someone else. The running, the waving, the shouts had not been intended for him. And the green man was not a man at all, but a woman. It is difficult to say why this surprised him so. Granted the human form, he was presumably as likely to meet a female as a male. But it did surprise him. So that only when the two islands once more began to fall apart into separate wave valleys did he realize that he had said nothing to her, but stood staring like a fool. And now that she was out of sight, he found his brain on fire with doubts. Was this what he had been sent to meet? He had been expecting wonders, had been prepared for wonders, but not prepared for a goddess carved apparently out of green stone, yet alive. And then it flashed across his mind. He had not noticed it while the scene was before him, that she had been strangely accompanied. She had stood up amidst a throng of beasts and birds as a tall sapling stands among bushes, big pigeon-coloured birds and flame-coloured birds and dragons and beaver-like creatures about the size of rats and heraldic-looking fish in the sea at her feet. Or had he imagined that? Was this the beginning of the hallucinations he had feared? Or another myth coming out into the world of fact? Perhaps a more terrible myth of Circe or Alcina. And the expression on her face, what had she expected to find that made the finding of him such a disappointment? The other island became visible again. He had been right about the animals. They surrounded her 10 or 20 deep, all facing her, most of them motionless, but some of them finding their places, as at a ceremony, with delicate, noiseless movements. The birds were in long lines, and more of them seemed to be alighting on the island every moment and joining these lines. From a wood of bubble trees behind her, half a dozen creatures like very short-legged and elongated pigs, the dachshunds of the pig world, were waddling up to join the assembly. Tiny frog-like beasts, like those he had seen falling in the rain, kept leaping about her, sometimes higher than her head, sometimes alighting on her shoulders. Their colours were so vivid that at first he mistook them for kingfishers. Amidst all this she stood looking at him, her feet together, her arms hanging at her sides, her stare level and unafraid, communicating nothing. Ransom determined to speak, using the old solar tongue. "I am from another world," he began, and then stopped. The green lady had done something for which he was quite unprepared. She raised her arm and pointed at him, not as in menace, but as though inviting the other creatures to behold him. At the same moment her face changed again, and for a second he thought she was going to cry. Instead, she burst into laughter, peal upon peal of laughter, till her whole body shook with it, till she bent almost double, with her hands resting on her knees, still laughing and repeatedly pointing at him. The animals, like our own dogs in similar circumstances, dimly understood that there was merriment afoot. All manner of gambolling, wing-clapping, snorting, and standing upon hind legs began to be displayed. And still the green lady laughed, till yet again the wave divided them, and she was out of sight. Ransom was thunderstruck. Had the Eldela sent him to meet an idiot, or an evil spirit that mocked men? Or was it, after all, a hallucination? For this was just how a hallucination might be expected to behave. Then an idea occurred to him which would have taken much longer, perhaps, to occur to me or you. It might not be she who was mad, but he who was ridiculous. He glanced down at himself. Certainly his legs presented an odd spectacle, for one was brownish-red, like the flanks of a Titian satyr, and the other was white, by comparison almost a leprous white. As far as self-inspection could go, he had the same parti-coloured appearance all over, no unnatural result of his one-sided exposure to the sun during the voyage. Had this been the joke? He felt a momentary impatience with the creature who could mar the meeting of two worlds with laughter at such a triviality. Then he smiled in spite of himself at the very undistinguished career he was having on Perelandra. For dangers he had been prepared, but to be first a disappointment and then an absurdity. Hello, here were the lady and her island in sight again. She had recovered from her laughter and sat with her legs trailing in the sea, half unconsciously caressing a gazelle-like creature which had thrust its soft nose under her arm. It was difficult to believe that she had ever laughed, ever done anything but sit on the shore of her floating isle. Never had Ransom seen a face so calm and so unearthly, despite the full humanity of every feature. He decided afterwards that the unearthly quality was due to the complete absence of that element of resignation which mixes, in however slight a degree, with all profound stillness in terrestrial faces. This was a calm which no storm had ever preceded. It might be idiocy, it might be immortality, it might be some condition of mind to which terrestrial experience offered no clue at all. A curious and rather horrifying sensation crept over him. On the ancient planet Malacandra he had met creatures who were not even remotely human in form, but who had turned out, on further acquaintance, to be rational and friendly. Under an alien exterior he had discovered a heart like his own. Was he now to have the reverse experience? For now he realized that the word human refers to something more than the bodily form, or even to the rational mind. It refers also to that community of blood and experience which unites all men and women on the earth. But this creature was not of his race. No windings, however intricate, of any genealogical tree could ever establish a connection between himself and her. In that sense, not one drop in her veins was human. The universe had produced her species and his quite independently. All this passed through his mind very quickly, and was speedily interrupted by his consciousness that the light was changing. At first he thought that the green creature had, of herself, begun to turn bluish and to shine with a strange electric radiance. Then he noticed that the whole landscape was a blaze of blue and purple, and almost at the same time that the two islands were not so close together as they had been. He glanced at the sky. The many-coloured furnace of the short-lived evening was kindled all about him. In a few minutes it would be pitch black, and the islands were drifting apart. Speaking slowly in that ancient language, he cried out to her, "I am a stranger. I come in peace. Is it your will that I swim over to your land?" The green lady looked quickly at him with an expression of curiosity. "What is peace?" she asked. Ransom could have danced with impatience. Already it was visibly darker, and there was no doubt now that the distance between the islands was increasing. Just as he was about to speak again, a wave rose between them, and once more she was out of sight. And as that wave hung above him, shining purple in the light of the sunset, he noticed how dark the sky beyond it had become. It was already through a kind of twilight that he looked down from the next ridge upon the other island far below him. He flung himself into the water. For some seconds he found a difficulty in getting clear of the shore. Then he seemed to succeed and struck out. Almost at once he found himself back again among the red weeds and bladders. A moment or two of violent struggling followed, and then he was free, and swimming steadily. And then, almost without warning, swimming in total darkness. He swam on, but despair of finding the other land, or even of saving his life, now gripped him. The perpetual change of the great swell abolished all sense of direction. It could only be by chance that he would land anywhere. Indeed, he judged from the time he had already been in the water that he must have been swimming along the space between the islands instead of across it. He tried to alter his course, then doubted the wisdom of this, tried to return to his original course, and became so confused that he could not be sure he had done either. He kept on telling himself that he must keep his head. He was beginning to be tired. He gave up all attempts to guide himself. Suddenly, a long time after, he felt vegetation sliding past him. He gripped and pulled. Delicious smells of fruit and flowers came to him out of the darkness. He pulled harder still on his aching arms. Finally he found himself safe and panting on the dry, sweet-scented, undulating surface of an island.